silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We have some special guests with us. They are students from Oshkosh West. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. If you want to know something about the case, we have summaries available, and they're outside, and it might help you. I know you're only staying for a short time, but you may go get them and read them as you listen. And they're here for just a short time because they're going on to cheer their girls' basketball team at the state tournament. So we wish you luck. I can't say we want you to win because I don't know against whom you're playing, and there may be alumnus here from high schools against whom you're playing, but we do wish you well, and thank you for coming. I'll now call our case of 03-2934, State versus Michael S. Jr., arguing on behalf of Mr. Michael S. Jr. is Susan E. Is it Alicia?
Alicia,
Assistant State Public Defender. Before you start, I see other students to my far right. Where are they from? Pardon me? Oh, well, you do, but good. Well, won't you stand up? Good. You too. We're delighted to have you. You aren't on my list, which is why I did not introduce you. And you may come to court and not be introduced, but looked as if you needed an introduction. So we're delighted to have you. Are you with a particular class or group?
I'm here with Susan. Well, Susan already in the trip, but it's not.
Okay. Well, you two are invited to get summaries of the case. And the deputy, the marshal is bringing in summaries for anyone who needs it. You may be seated. I think you'll find the case very interesting. Thank you. Okay, we're ready for you.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Susan Alicia, and I am the attorney representing Michael S. today. He's the petitioner in this case. Michael's dispositional order expired on October 23, 2002. And when that order expired, the juvenile court lost personal jurisdiction over Michael, as well as the competency to proceed in Michael's case. Now, if you were the judge in the juvenile court, Michael's mom comes to you on October 24th, and she says, "Your Honor, my son's order expired yesterday. Get him out of secure detention. I want to take him home." What do you do? Well, you might look at the court file. There's nothing in there, no order saying that this has been temporarily extended. You could check with the clerk. You could check the minutes. You could check the court reporters. There's nothing. You find nothing that says that this order has been extended.
Well, counsel, couldn't you ask, well, why did his defense counsel go along with the hearing date?
You could ask that. Defense counsel was in a room with a district attorney and the judge. Nobody at that hearing acknowledged the expiration date of this order. What happened at that October 2nd hearing was a scheduling. Everyone said, we need to come back. Here's the date. There's no discussion by any party or anyone about what that meant or the expiration of the order. I don't think it's incumbent entirely on defense counsel to raise that issue.
No, I don't. I'm not saying that, but there's be a possibility maybe it was waived. But under the circumstances, in all looking at this in the total picture, there were some things to be performed before that hearing, such as a second psychological, which was asked by defense counsel.
That's correct.
Yes. And other things. And did they look at other dates?
Did they what?
Did they look at other dates? That was the first
date? No, that was the date that was given. The October 24th date was given and accepted. So, yes, that's true. The defense counsel did say, I'm considering a second psychological. But I don't think that that is relevant in looking at the date of the expiration of the warrant.
So you want a rule that absolutely always, bright line, never, no extension, and that is what it should be.
My rule would be that the order has to be temporarily extended by the court.
And now, the state doesn't argue that it's retroactive. I mean, such as I think Judge Foley indicated, well, but they argue that they, under the statute, there is that ability to extend. In other words, to go beyond that point because of what is in the record.
My understanding of the state's argument isn't that it can be done retroactively, but that it was done at the time.
That it can or cannot be.
My understanding of the state's argument is that it cannot be done retroactively, and that is not what happened in this case.
Well, what about waiver? Does it have to be intentionally, knowingly, voluntarily waive the time period, or is it more in the sense of you're stopped and if you haven't claimed it, it's gone?
Well, the way I see that this played out, and I think that's important to answer the question, is that this order expired and it was not extended.
So it's not an issue of waiver.
That's correct.
But what about the concept that, look, everybody is sitting there. The judge says, okay, we're doing it October 24. No one says anything. The judge doesn't say, I'm extending the time, but obviously the judge intends to have a hearing on a day in which that court could, whether you call it competence or anything else, could have the hearing, right? I mean, the judge isn't setting it deliberately at a time when it's got a problem, right?
That's correct.
So it is doing that. And so, you know, then here Judge Foley says, in effect, well, I might not have used the magic words, I am extending the time, but by entering an order for October 24, implicit in that order is I am extending the time. What's the matter with that?
And I do want to clarify something. In preparing for oral argument, there's a lot of talk about magic words in the Court of Appeals opinion. Mm-hmm. And in preparing for oral argument, what I decided is that my position is to take the focus away from that magic words. I'm not going to ask you that in order to reverse the Court of Appeals, you have to find that there's been a request or that you have to find that the judge cited the statute or that he referred to the statute. Okay, I'm not going to ask you to do that because I don't think you need to do that under my facts. Because under my facts, the judge did not extend this order. And if a judge does not extend the order, then it becomes irrelevant as to whether anybody asked him to or not.
But he had to enter an order saying, I'm extending it. Is that your position?
I see him as having two options, that being one, entering a written order saying I've extended this, or the other option would be for him to extend the order on the record. See, what I think happened in this case is he did not do that. This was scheduled for another hearing. What happened at this hearing was a scheduling, not an extension of the order. And that's a critical difference because in order to extend an order, I think you need to know that there's an order that needs to be extended. He admits on the record that, well, that wasn't in his consciousness. He wasn't thinking that the order expired on the 23rd. So for us to turn around and in retrospect say, well, he extended the order, well, he didn't extend the order because he didn't know when the order expired.
Counselor, how, if at all, does Section 938.315 sub 3 fit in with how we should decide this case?
My position is it doesn't factor into this case at all.
Why is that?
Because the expiration of an order is not a time limit. And that section applies to time limits. This is not a time limit. This is an entirely different situation than the time limit analysis. And if you're not looking at a time limit, then that's a statutory section won't come into play.
The state does a lot of arguing here in its brief in regard to Nikrut and the decision of this court in regard to the issue of waiver of competency. I think I know what your response is, but why don't you tell us exactly how you respond to that argument?
Sure. The simple response is Nikrut doesn't apply to my case.
Why?
It doesn't apply for two reasons. One, what happened in my case, when that order expired, the court lost personal jurisdiction over Michael. Nikrut is a competency case. That's personal jurisdiction. So we don't get into Nikrut because what happened here was a loss of personal jurisdiction. The second response to that is if this court heads into the competency area and wants to apply Nikrut, I say this isn't the kind of competence that Nikrut dealt with. I struggle with this in looking at Nikrut and saying, well, Nikrut is the loss of competence if the court fails to apply a statutory mandate. The court doesn't do that and it loses competence. That's what Nikrut talks about. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the facts and the statute in this case, and I was getting frustrated with myself, thinking, what statutory mandate exactly isn't the court following? And I went around and around on it, and finally I thought, I'm struggling with this because this isn't a case where the court's not following the statutory mandate. This is a case where the order expired. In other words, there are different kinds of competency, and this isn't the kind of competency issue that Nikrut dealt with. This is the expiration of an order, and it's a different situation. So,
why do you say that there was a loss of personal jurisdiction?
Because personal jurisdiction attached in this case when the petition was filed against Michael. At some point, it has to end. Personal jurisdiction over a juvenile can't go on forever. I have a 7-year-old son. In a few years, he would be old enough to have a petition filed against him. So let's say he's in the 4th grade, and a petition is filed against him. He's 10. That doesn't mean the juvenile court has personal jurisdiction over him until he's an adult. It means when his order would expire, that's the end. Their personal jurisdiction also ends.
What about the fact that the young man was there on the 24th? Is he not submitting to the jurisdiction of the court?
He was in custody at the time. He was in secure detention, so they brought him in.
Okay. Isn't that a submission to the personal jurisdiction of the court?
Well, I would argue that it was not because of the fact that he was brought in custody.
So you're saying because it was an involuntary appearance, the court did not have personal jurisdiction.
That's right. And the other critical point, I think, to remember is that at that hearing on the 24th, when Michael appeared, this issue came up. And Judge Malmsted said to Michael, I don't think I have any jurisdiction over you. I don't think I can proceed, but I'm going to give you a choice. You can walk out of here and be done, or you can allow me to keep you on probation, and we have these wonderful services for you, and you can take advantage of them and make your life better. Which choice do you want to make? And Michael said, the first choice, the first one.
I want to go home with one.
I want to go home. And so when put to Michael in that situation, he said, I do not, in kid terms, I don't agree to you keeping personal jurisdiction over me. I want out.
I ask, was there a psychological done for the defense?
There was never a second psychological done, no. Defense counsel apparently never followed up with that.
Well, I'm looking at the calendar. The October 2nd is a Wednesday. And so, and the defendant said, I think I want to get a psychological. So it would seem to me it would have been completely unreasonable for the court to have a trial on the 2nd or the 3rd, because that wouldn't have given any real time. The probation agent was not present from the 4th through the 15th. So there is the 16th, 17th, 18th, 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. Which are working days in which this hearing could have been held. The court set it at the 24th. And the defendant didn't object. And when the thing was finally held on the 24th, the defendant didn't object again until the judge raised the issue. I mean, why isn't that waiver?
It's not waiver, again, because defense counsel articulated a reason as well, and I haven't talked about that, so maybe we should discuss that. He's in the position of being at this hearing. Now, he, as it turned out, was not aware of when the order expired either. But if he were, that I do not believe that it's defense counsel, as advocate counsel's duty at that point to say, oh, court, my client's about to walk away from probation, which is something he very much wants, but I think you should probably check the calendar again and schedule this one day earlier. There's a role for each person in this courtroom. In BJN, this court addressed a similar issue. In that case, the hearing was scheduled timely. The mother, her attorney called the court and said, boy, I can't, you got to reschedule, I can't make this time. It was then rescheduled to a date beyond the time that it could be. The mother did that. The mother then comes in and says, oh, I object, you've lost competency.
And is the failure to raise any question about a hearing on the 24th, if the defendant or the defendant's counsel had said, 24th is one day beyond the time period, then I see 6 days after the probation agent is back that the court could have moved heaven and earth, done it at night, called in another judge, but there was silence. And how can you argue that the defendant should take advantage of that silence?
Well, and let me put it this way. We have a judge. We have, say, a plea hearing, and the judge forgets to tell the defendant the maximum penalties. Okay? Kind of a straightforward plea withdrawal issue. Defense counsel doesn't have the legal obligation at that point to say, Your Honor, you've forgotten to tell my client the maximum penalties. What can happen then on post-conviction is the defendant can come back and say, I didn't know the maximum penalties and you didn't tell me, and the plea can be withdrawn. So there are situations where I think in BJN, this court ended up saying it's the responsibility of the petitioner to move things along. Okay, we extended, this delay was really actually caused by the mother, but it's the petitioner. They should know the dates. And that plea situation
but
would be the court's responsibility.
Didn't the petitioner in this case ask for an expedited hearing?
The petitioner did, a quick hearing, or right. Although in the context of the transcript, I think you'll see that that came up because there was concern because Michael was in secure detention. And so when a child is in secure detention, they tend to want to move things along more quickly. So there wasn't any suggestion that we need to move this along because the expiration's coming up. It was, well, Michael's in secure detention, how quickly can we do this?
Why can't we rely on the last sentence of 938.365 sub 6 that was added after the BJN case?
That sentence, which is failure to object if a hearing is not held within the time limit specified in this subsection, waives the time limit, applies to the 30 days only. When you read the statute altogether, you'll see that they do get an additional 30 days, a temporary extension. What that sentence refers to is if a hearing is set beyond that temporary extension, in other words, the court says, I'm going to grant a temporary extension of 30 days, and then sets the hearing for 45 days, and counsel doesn't object, then what this says is, well, you've waived that objection. But it doesn't apply to the expiration of an order that hasn't been extended. That order then has expired. We're not talking about a time limit anymore. We're talking about the expiration of an order.
So if I could summarize what I think your position is, correct me if I'm wrong, what you're saying is that once a court actually loses jurisdiction, it can't do something to get it back as opposed to a time limits issue. Am I stating that correctly?
Yes.
And your position is that in order to hold a hearing outside of October 23, there had to be an extension of time.
Yes.
There was no such extension of time, and the objection
I should put it differently, the defendant did not have to make an objection to this hearing because the hearing is void anyway because there was no extension of time and it was the state's obligation and the court's obligation to be sure that the extension of time was put in.
Yes.
Are you saying that if the petitioners asked for a 30-day extension and then a hearing is held after the 30-day extension and no one objects to that, that's okay, but if a hearing is set one day after disposition and nothing, there's no objection, that's fatal?
Because of the part of the statute that you cited, that's correct. Because
does that make any sense?
It does, because the order expires, let's use these facts, on the 23rd of October. It expires and the court loses personal jurisdiction and competency. Done, over, cannot be regained. Under this circumstance, where you've scheduled the hearing, the court still has competency because the hearing's been scheduled. There isn't the expiration of the order because you've scheduled this hearing for this temporary extension, and then the statute specifically says, well, you've got your 30 days. If you don't notice that it's gone beyond these 30 days in this time limit, again, we're talking about a time limit instead of the expiration of an order, then you've waived that and we can proceed.
Counsel, I didn't want to interrupt you, but in other words, if defense counsel says, just take this case itself, I need a psychological judge, I'd like to do it on the 24th, and everyone says fine, has there been a waiver?
I argue the same thing. The order expires on the 23rd.
So it makes no difference if, okay.
Now, do I remember the facts correctly? Judge Wall, who was involved in this case, what in the record suggests that he knew or had reason to believe that the order had expired already?
Well, just so we're talking about the same thing, we've got Judge Foley, and then we have Judge Malmstead.
And then Judge
we have Judge Foley again, and then we have Judge Wall.
Okay, let's go in order. I think with regard to Malmstead, what did he say that indicated that he didn't have, that the order had expired? What was that?
It was towards the end of the hearing, and he apparently looked at the piece of paper that said, the dispositional order itself, to see that it had expired the day before. And so to him, it was a quick deduction. This order has expired. Surely this must have been extended temporarily, right? And then everyone shrugs and says, apparently not. And his conclusion is my conclusion. If this order has expired, I can't act on this.
What was Judge Foley's position with regard to it expiring? As I recall, he tried to retroactively, I mean, he knew that it had to be done within the 30-day period, so he did it outside the 30-day period, but almost like a nunk-pro-tunk, effective as though it were within the 30-day period. Is that correct?
That's correct. His reaction was what happened then over the lunch hour was Judge Malmstead, who had already decided that he had lost jurisdiction, but I think he said, I want to go over this with a fine-tooth comb. And so he went and spoke to Judge Foley. And together, I think, they checked the minutes, the file, and then the court reporters as well, and concluded there had not been an extension. Judge Foley then came back initially without defense counsel present, and then again later in the day with defense counsel present, and said, well, and I was just looking for the quote because it's pretty revealing. It was something along the lines of, well, this order wasn't extended, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it was that clear. And he also said, because what I'm going to do now is retroactively extend this order. Later, he comes back and says, well, actually, I didn't retroactively extend it exactly. What I did was extend it by inference at the time. So his initial reaction is the retroactivity, and he does move away from that some in a later hearing.
Well, what's the problem with the extended by inference approach?
Well, the problem I have with all of this is that on a practical level, this order was never extended. And so everyone, I think, agrees that it wasn't on anybody's mind that this order was going to expire on the 23rd. So to say I extended it by inference when nobody knew the order was going to expire seems nonsensical to me. How do we know the hearing was set on the 24th? How do we know if Judge Foley had actually been aware of the fact the order expired on the 23rd that he might have gotten a hearing a little sooner? Because now it went up in priority. It was more important. Gosh, we have an order expiring. Suddenly this bumps a few other things I have. We don't know because he didn't know. And so when you look at the statute, he has to be unable. And we don't know if he's unable because he didn't know that the order expired. So I don't think you can use the inference analysis when there's a complete unknowing on everyone's part.
Counselor, I want to go back to an earlier question that was asked of you. Why should we conclude that because the dispositional order expired, and the court has lost jurisdiction, when, in fact, the statute, 938.365.6, even though I understand your argument, doesn't apply to the circumstance, says if an extension order expires, the court doesn't lose jurisdiction. Does it have to be in a statute? Could we have had a statute that says if the dispositional order expires, the court doesn't lose jurisdiction? And if your answer would be yes, is it necessary that it be in a statute?
Well, I do think it's necessary that it be in the statute, because right now what we have is the expiration of an order and the loss of jurisdiction.
But you see, I want you to tell me why I have to come to the conclusion that when the order expires, you lose jurisdiction, because that's really the nub of the case. And, you know, if it's just the expiration of an order, well, that's okay until you look at subsection 6, which I understand you say doesn't apply to this order, but there the order expires and you don't lose jurisdiction.
Right, but something is still pending. I guess I would say that the legislature has addressed that specifically then, and they have not addressed the expiration.
We had a matter pending here when the order expired. And I agree with you that that's what sub 6 speaks to. There's something pending. So that's why jurisdiction is confusing. But sometimes the legislature just tries to make things clearer for all of us, which is helpful because then when something comes up, we know. But the import behind the statute is when something is pending, well, then you haven't lost personal jurisdiction. And here, you had something pending. In fact, you had a hearing that was pending at the request of Michael, who didn't want it done more quickly because his lawyer wanted to do some other things. So I guess, why shouldn't we say when something's pending, you don't lose jurisdiction?
Well, it seems to me that, again, on the 23rd when the order expires, what is pending? I mean, there is nothing at that point because the court can't do anything.
No, but you see, you're filling in the blanks for me with a conclusion. I mean, my problem is I could see saying there is something pending. I could see there's a hearing on. It was a hearing that all parties agreed to. And so there is something pending. There's a matter that's pending in regard to Michael. Just like under subsection 6, when that order expires, the legislature tells us you don't lose jurisdiction, and essentially because there's something pending. So I guess my question is to you, why do we have to have a statute if something pending is good enough to keep personal jurisdiction?
Well, this statute isn't so broad as to say if something's pending.
I understand your argument. I wasn't trying to get you to say to me the statute applies. I was looking more at what the reasoning is under the statute and saying to you, well, you know, sometimes the legislature tells us the answer to the question, but sometimes they don't, but it doesn't mean the answer's not the same.
Right.
Is something pending good enough to keep personal jurisdiction?
Well, my answer is no, unless they have done something this specific, because where does that lead us? As I said, there has to be an end. There has to be an end. We can't take a 10-year-old and keep him till he's a 17-year-old.
I agree, but they were only trying to keep him for the next hearing at this point. So. But thank you. Thank you. It's a hard question, I know.
Ms.
Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you. And may it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state in this case. It's our position, as it was the Court of Appeals ruling, that we believe that you should affirm that by setting the contested hearing date on the state's petition to extend the dispositional order for October 24th, which was well within the 30 days allowed for a temporary extension, after having specifically considered the state's request for an expedited hearing, the unavailability of the probation agent who would be a necessary witness until the 15th, the court's own extremely crowded calendar with TPR trials and needing to hold preliminaries on kids that he knew were coming in, 10 kids that were going to be charged in homicides, and the defense counsel's request that he was going to be asking for a second psychological exam, and he didn't know how long that would take. I think he said, I don't know how quick that will be, that the court, in effect, granted a temporary extension until October 24th. The only thing the court did not do is specifically refer to 938-365 sub 6 or call it a temporary extension.
How about this? The only thing the court didn't do is realize that the order had expired and there was a need for an extension. How do you respond to me, the simple but compelling argument that you can't say the court extended it because the court never realized there was a need to extend it?
Nobody brought out the expiration date at the hearing and mentioned it, but it was on the pleading to extend the dispositional order in the first place. It said when it expires. So, I mean, everyone knew on one level. They maybe weren't thinking about it and articulating it at that point. But it seems to me that if we can tell from the record, and we can here, that as a practical matter, the court could not hold it by the expiration date.
Let me tell two things that greatly concern me about this case. As I see it, number one, everyone knew that an order has to be extended before the 30 days runs. Judge Malmstead knew that. That was the understanding of the law of Judge Wall. That was the understanding of the law of Judge Sullivan. Everyone knows you have to extend before the time runs. That's why Sullivan, Foley, you know, who are all those Irish guys. That's why. Excuse me, Justice Betsy. That's why Judge Foley, you know, did these gymnastics. You know, come on. Who are we trying to kid? Everyone knows that before it expires, you have to extend it. I know that. They know that. Now, we may be all wrong. I might be wrong on the law. They may be wrong on the law. But that has always been my understanding of the law, and it's their understanding of the law. Now, it might be wrong, but I'm saying that's their understanding, and that's clear from the record. So we have here a judge where mistakes were made, you know, and all of us are human, and we all make mistakes. So why are we trying to invert, jump around, or have a fact situation that you can do it if there's a request already filed, and there's a calendar that's congested, and there's a probation agent that's not involved or around, and there's, you know, to make such a fact-specific case, why are we going through such mental gymnastics to reach a conclusion that is catastrophic? Catastrophic in this sense. With deadlines having no teeth, they are meaningless. If you can infer extension by one day, why can't your analysis say he could have set it for December 23rd and infer it? Because God knows he has a busy calendar and he does until then. Or January 2nd, do it by inference. And then we have a children's court and run in Milwaukee and in this state where deadlines are meaningless. So that's my concern. Everyone knows it. They blew it. So why should we change the system to try to recover this case?
I think what we're saying is that there are two ways to extend an order, and obviously the most common and the preferable way, and the way I'm sure Judge Foley does it most of the time because he's very experienced, is to specifically say on the record, the order expires here, or someone else will say it on the record, defense counsel or the state, and then say, we can't hold the hearing by the 23rd, therefore when I'm extending it.
When, to what date could he have extended it lawfully under 6?
There isn't a date specific. He can extend it for 30 days, but not counting the periods in 938, 315, sub 1. So, and there's like A through H or Y or I or J of those. So if any of those were built into it, for example, if the child needed to go for competency, a mental competency exam, or if defense counsel was and the juvenile were asking for the extension, and here, crowded court calendar. So if, for example, the court could not have held it until November 2nd in the first instance, it could have done that, I think, within the statute.
Can they extend it again another 30 days and another 30 days?
There is no limit in the statutory language.
Okay.
As long as each period falls within one of those things that stops the clock from running under 938.315 sub 1. Now, my understanding is that at least in Milwaukee, what they usually do is set the date for within the 30 days, and then if further extensions are necessary, they do it. But I don't think the statute would absolutely require that.
Ms. Wellman, let me ask. I seem to recall, and I may be in error, and it's been a long time since I had to do this, but I seem to recall that there was a line of cases, I want to say subject matter jurisdiction cases, that basically stood for the proposition that once a court lost jurisdiction, it could not get it back. I want to say Kittrell versus State rings the bell. I don't know if that's the right one or not. But my question is, does that extend to personal jurisdiction cases? Does that extend to competency?
I don't know about personal jurisdiction cases because I've not seen a case where once the court acquired jurisdiction, in this case it would be by the filing of the delinquency petition, this court or the Court of Appeals has said that the court then loses personal jurisdiction because of something subsequently that happens. Most of the personal jurisdiction cases are about acquiring personal jurisdiction. I think the theory underlies BJN. I don't know that they say it in so many words, but the theory there was that because the temporary extension was granted, but then it wasn't complied with, that the order expired and therefore the court had no jurisdiction. In that case, they called it competency to exercise. The court, I don't think, expressly said, and there's nothing you can do to get it back, but I think that's a fair reading of that. And we would agree in this case, if nothing had happened, if September came and went, October came and went, the state didn't file a petition to extend the dispositional order, the court didn't hold a hearing and set the hearing for the contested hearing, and in essence we say extend the order by doing that after considering the relevant factors. If the date just came and went, and for some reason nobody noticed, and 3 weeks later the kid's sitting in detention saying, hey, wasn't I supposed to get out by Halloween? And everybody says, oh, my gosh. And we agree. I mean, at that point, we would not argue the state could go back or the court could go back and do an extension hearing.
And the reason for that, as I understand it, the reason for these fixed dates in the Juvenile Justice Code and in the termination of parental rights, for example, the reason is you want these proceedings to move along. You're dealing with children. The court has limited jurisdiction over them in the sense of temporally. I mean, they get to be 18 or 19 or whatever the particular age is. They are gone. And you want these proceedings to move rapidly and that people know if it's Monday, that's what the court is supposed to be doing. Maybe you disagree with that as the concept under BJN.
Well, I think there certainly is the reason for the time limits is to keep things moving, to make sure things don't just get lost in the system. Obviously, after the line of cases that started BJN, RH, and way back there, where there were no extensions of time limits, and we didn't have 938.315, and we didn't have the language in sub 6 of 938.365, obviously, things were much tighter than now the system has recognized, and the legislature has recognized, well, while that is a goal, reality is that both volumes and the need of the child often require that things take longer than we would like in a perfect world. What we're seeing here is that, in essence, the first order, and SDR recognized this back before, when the statute read somewhat differently, in essence, in terms of the liberty interest, the child has 13 months before he has a liberty, a reasonable expectation of a liberty interest. That's the 12 months of the year plus the 30 days. Now, the legislature then amended the statute to say, well, we want you to make the request beforehand, because what was happening under SDR was that you could wait until the order expired and then come in, and as long as you're still within the 30 days, make the request. And that wasn't a very effective or efficient system. So now you have to make the request beforehand. Try to hold the hearing if you can, but if the court can't. And in this case, all of that happened except the overt recognition of the expiration date. But we believe that by setting the date within the 30 days, after taking consideration of all of the calendar problems, the unavailability of the agent, the need for a second exam, that in effect, as a practical matter, what the court did was extend that order until the 24th.
That's an extension by inference?
Yes. I guess I wouldn't necessarily have used that term, but I can't really disagree with it. And, you know, when we talk about what Judge Foley, I just want to make sure that we mention this. I mentioned this. On page 6 of our brief, we quote Judge Foley's second discussion of the matter. And it's from the record at 53:22-23. And what he says is, in the context of this case, is evidence in the record. Even though the court doesn't say the magic words, that meaning granting temporary extension, in fact, is what happened. And I think that's a key here. I didn't say the magic words. Also, we have the express request to extend. We couldn't conduct the hearing within the time left because of the nature of the conditions of the calendar, crowded conditions of the calendar. Mr. Hackbarth, that was defense counsel, asking for the psychological. So we set it over a date that is one day beyond the original expiration, but well within the temporary 30 days extension that I should have formally ordered, but in effect ordered by inference. So I guess he planted that term for us. I hadn't remembered to use that term. But, I mean, I think that, you know, what the court was saying is, as a reality, that's what happened here. We looked at the calendar. We couldn't schedule it beforehand. Yeah, nobody mentioned specifically expires on the 23rd, and that's our position. Sure, everybody should have been. I mean, the prosecutor maybe should have mentioned it. The court should have been more aware of it. But defense counsel should have objected at that point.
But let me ask this, Ms. Wellman, because I'm looking now at pages 106 and 107 of the blue brief in the appendix, and that's the actual order of judging the juvenile delinquent dated November 6, 2001, signed by Judge Wasleski. And it says date order expires October 23rd, 2002. Unless something is done different to change that date, this order expires on that date, right?
Unless something is done different.
And I guess I'm troubled by orders by inference. That's a troubling concept. It's one thing to have an oral order. It's one thing to have a written order. It's another thing to divine a judge's intent.
Well, it's certainly not preferable. We would agree with that. But I think what we have to recognize is that the reality here is that something did happen. You know, if the state had filed its request to extend the dispositional order back in September as it did, and then nothing happened until after October 23rd, we would not be arguing that the court could go back and say, well, if I had held a hearing on October 2nd, and if I had looked at my calendar on October 2nd, then I would have made a ruling, blah, blah. That's not really what happened here. Certainly, it would have been preferable for the court to say, looking at October 23rd, looking at the calendar, looking at unavailability and all the factors he discussed, I am going to extend this for one day. And he didn't do that. This is, you know, as far as I know, this is extremely rare. I mean, I am not aware of this occurring very often, or if before, where, you know, just no one happens to mention overtly the expiration date or call it an order, a temporary extension order.
Ms. Wellman, this all happened 2.5 years ago.
Right.
Is there mootness here?
Well, it's certainly moot in the sense that nothing this court orders can have any practical effect on Michael. He is out. He's off paper, unless he's been picked up for something else, which would be another matter altogether. Anything you do, affirming, reversing, cannot affect him. So it's moot in that sense. Certainly, this court can reach issues that are moot if they're of great public interest, they're of a recurring nature. The lower courts need guidance on the matter, and generally juvenile issues are the kind that can evade review because of the time it takes in the system. If this court is simply going to do what the Court of Appeals did, which we don't have any problem with the court doing it that way, and just say we're going to decide on this record that the court did comply with the statute and did grant a temporary extension, I think that issue is moot because it's so fact-specific. If this court is going to reach the issues left open in Mikrut, which is whether a challenge to the court's competency to exercise jurisdiction is waived when it involves a failure to comply with a statutory deadline or here 938-365-6, or if it is going to decide whether the failure to strictly adhere to and expressly state there's a temporary order is something that would deprive the court of competency to exercise jurisdiction, then those are much broader issues. I think the courts do need guidance after Mikrut, because obviously the court reached a holding there that for every other kind of competency challenge says it's waived, but said we're just not going to address this other whole line of juvenile cases because it wasn't before them. And if this court wants to reach that issue, then I think that would overcome the mootness problem. So that's why we didn't do a motion to dismiss, because I think it may or may not be moot depending on, or it may or may not be something you want to reach depending on what issues you see.
And you feel that Mikrut really needs some explanation in this type of situation?
Well, I think in both Chapter 48 and 938, after Mikrut, the courts, because the court in Mikrut didn't reach that issue and the old line of cases is still out there, I think the Court of Appeals at least is having to decide in each case, did Mikrut, you know, what would this court do if it had this question before it? And you do have another case, you have a TPR case. It's footnoted in defense counsel's reply brief. I'm forgetting the name of it right now. In late termination of Matthew S., I think. And the briefs have been filed in that case. And it does also raise the Mikrut issue. Although, you know, that is a TPR case and it's under the statutes in Chapter 48, which may be a little different from our case.
Well, and Mikrut left open more generally the time limit statutes.
Right.
Not limited, although they refer to BJN a number of times, not limited to 48 or 938.
Right, right.
But any time limit statute was not touched.
Right.
Now, at least it's arguable that that's what Mikrut says.
Right. One could also argue, I mean, I think defense counsel, if I understand her argument correctly, is saying, well, I'm not sure what she's saying. I thought at first she was saying that this should be treated the same as the what she's calling the time limit exception in Mikrut, because it's like a time limit exception, and expiration is the ultimate time limit. She's now arguing because in 939.315.3 doesn't apply that it's not a time limit. So, I mean, I suppose you could say Mikrut already controls this case, because if this is not a time limit and Mikrut says all other kinds of competency challenges are waived if they're not raised below, then he would have waived it under Mikrut. I don't think any of us have been reading it quite that way, but that's one way to look at it.
Justice Prosser?
Was there a delay in the, would you characterize the October 24th hearing as a delay?
No, I wouldn't characterize it as a delay, because that was the date set for the contested hearing, and it was well within the initial 30 days for the temporary extension the court could order. Maybe I'm not understanding your question.
The hearing was not scheduled on October 23rd or before October 23rd.
Well, it's our position it was. It was scheduled on October 2nd for October 24th.
All right. But, I mean, it wasn't scheduled to be held October 23rd or a date before that.
Yes, you're correct. It was not.
What I'm really trying to get at is can you rely at all on 938.315.1DM, which is the following time period shall be excluded in computing time requirements within this chapter. DM, any period of delay resulting from court congestion or scheduling.
I think you can, although I think when you read that in conjunction with 938.365.6, that last line, I think it's possible to also read those to mean it only applies to that temporary extension. But the language in 938 itself is very broad. And certainly we believe that 938.3, saying that failures to comply with time requirements don't go to subject matter or personal or competency to exercise jurisdiction, is applicable here. Because in essence, what the defense counsel is arguing is that we didn't comply with the time limit for scheduling the temporary extension within the 30 days because the court didn't overtly do that. That's a time limit case. Sure, it's involved with the expiration of an order because that's what you're extending in the first place, and that's why you have to have the temporary extension. But to try to separate it out from all other time requirement cases in the statute, it seems to me is not a reasonable way to read the statutes.
Back in the good old days in Marathon County, when we had these kind of problems, in trial, heavy caseload, you just bring in another judge within the time period to handle it. And indeed, in this case, except it was a day after October 23rd, they brought in Malmstead to handle it. They brought in Wall to handle it. Is there anything in the record that suggests why they couldn't have brought in another judge within before the expiration to handle it?
That was not discussed in the record, and I don't know that the courts generally do that when they're setting these temporary extensions.
They did it when it came October 24th. They managed to get a couple of judges.
Right, they did. But I will also note that at that October 24th hearing, they discussed whether they should go ahead and hold the extension hearing that was scheduled or wait until Judge Foley was available, and defense counsel specifically said he would rather wait and have Judge Foley hear it. So from that, I think it's fair to infer that if on October 2nd, Judge Foley had said, well, let me go talk to Judge Mountainstead and see if he could do this on the 23rd, defense counsel might well have said, Judge, we prefer that you keep this case. I mean, we don't know that because it didn't happen. But he certainly did make that request at the October 24th hearing, and it was then set over again for Judge Foley to take it back. And there certainly is some benefit, especially if you're going to actually have the extension hearing itself, the extension of the dispositional order, from having some continuity with the judge.
Mr. Hackbarth agreed to the October 24th hearing?
Yes, he did.
In other words, he just didn't stand silent. He actually agreed to it?
He actually agreed. Originally, the clerk had offered the afternoon of October 24th, and he said, I can't do it in the afternoon. And then the state, I think, said, well, what about the next week? And he says, I can't do it the next week for these reasons. And then the clerk said, well, how about the morning of October 24th? And he said, yes, I could do the morning. And, in fact, they set it at 10:30 rather than 11 so that they would have enough time to do it at his request. So, I mean, he did more than just say nothing, as if, he was kind of dozing and didn't hear the date. And we do believe that to get back to the micro question of waiver, we do believe that that is a waiver, that the defense counsel on the juvenile's behalf has to object. When the court sets a date that's outside of a time limit, whatever that time limit might be, if defense counsel wants to protect the child's right to have it within a time limit or to make the court make a separate record, you know, that I'm extending it now under 938 sub 315 sub 1, he has to make an objection before the next hearing.
Here, as I understand it, defense counsel actively participated in the actual date. In other words, I know it was the judge or whoever said the 24th, but then he said, well, I can't in the afternoon, and I can't do it later on, but I can do it.
Right, right. So it was more than silence, certainly more than silence. Yes.
Let me ask this, because I have a different type of fact question regarding whether there was an extension of the order. If you go back and you look at what Judge Momstead did here, and this is before Judge Foley did his relation back order, Judge Momstead gave, and I'm looking at page 12 of the defendant's brief, basically gave the juvenile two choices and said, those are your two options. And the juvenile claims the first, and the judge says, fine. Isn't that, in effect, an order that you're done? In other words, before you get to the Judge Foley order, Judge Momstead has already said, we've lost jurisdiction. How does now, in the wake of what Judge Momstead said, how does Judge Foley get jurisdiction to relate back?
Well, I guess I didn't read that fine as saying, fine, I'm dismissing this case for lack of jurisdiction. I think he was just saying, fine, I know what you've answered my question. He had already said, my gut reaction from what I have in front of me is that his order expired, but I want to go back and find out for sure. We're going to go through the record. We're going to talk to the court reporters. I'm going to talk to Judge Foley. So he had not made an actual ruling at that point.
Should we be at all concerned about the fact that Judge Momstead wouldn't extend, Judge Wall wouldn't extend, they both sent it back to Judge Foley?
Well, I think that was appropriate because I think, you know, it was Judge Foley who had made the initial ruling and set the date.
Tell you what bothers me. You got a statute, and maybe you don't think it's clear, but it looks clear to me. This and an order that says this disposition ends October 23. Statute tells you if you want to do something beyond that, and you as the state has to make a request for an extension. And you do it within a time limit that's set forth, and it's before the order ends. And then the court has limited time, whether it's a series of 30 days, but every 30 days there's a report period. That is, the court's got to do something to get rid of this case or keep extending it if that's allowed. The only one that is held to this under the state's position is the defendant. The court does or doesn't realize it's the 30 days that the order is up. Court's silent as to extension. The state does or doesn't realize the time is up, doesn't make a request, right? There's no request here for an extension within this time period.
Right. The state
does not. The state doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Too bad. States shouldn't be out of court. The only one that is out of court is, or the one that's in court here, is the defendant. And then everybody says, the court says, waiver, waiver. State says, waiver, waiver. What happened to everybody else here? Don't they have to suffer as a result of their waiver, their failure to comply? I mean, we're not going to hold the judge in contempt. We're not going to hold the state in contempt. We're not going to fine anybody. We just say, well, too bad, but the only one responsible for making sure that the statutes are complied with is the defendant. And if the defendant doesn't do it, that's a waiver. There's something, to me, there's something the matter with that. I don't think that's what the statute intended. I don't think that's a waiver.
I guess
why is it right to do this? Now, there's a public interest that this child, if in need of treatment, if dangerous or whatever, that we keep him under state control.
I mean, I recognize that. But there's also a public interest in these statutes that children are have the least restrictive kind of treatment, that they be handled promptly. We're trying to teach them how to obey the law. Shouldn't we be obeying the law? I mean, we have a shot. That's the best way of doing something.
Well, and it's our position that the court did obey the law because he did extend the order by his action of setting the date within the 30 days.
Without a request by the state.
Without a request. Well, the statute certainly does not require a request. The word request never appears there.
Oh, wait, I thought it did say request.
Request to extend the dispositional order, which was filed beforehand, but not a request for a temporary extension.
But doesn't it say you're supposed to get that, too?
It says if the court cannot hold the hearing within before the date expires, then it can extend. It doesn't say someone has to ask for it. I mean, the court could do it because of its own crowded calendar, too, certainly.
I'm sorry. Ms. Woman, I have one other question, factual question, that I don't have a handle on, and it's because I don't understand the juvenile code as well. So I want to make sure I'm getting it. The original order expires October 23rd. Assuming that the court has the power to extend the order 30 days, and we accept your argument, that would take us to either somewhere around November 22nd, November 23rd. The parties appeared in front of Judge Foley on November 26th. On December 3rd, the court grants the motion to extend Michael's order for 1 year. Is there some provision that's told somewhere in that time period that allows the court to do that? Because even under your argument, that's more than 30 days out.
Right, and yes, and what it is there 938.315 sub 1 says these certain things don't count in that time period. So while it's not exactly extending it, it's the clock stops running, and it did for each of the interventions between those hearings.
And that worked for that period.
Right. That's my understanding, too.
Can I ask you, is there any evidence that the juvenile code passed in the 95 legislature was in any way a reaction to the BJN case?
I don't know of any evidence in terms of legislative history, I mean, that statement in the legislative record, but it certainly is very clear from what they did, which is that they created 938.315 sub 3 to say failure to adhere to any time limit does not deprive the court of competency to exercise jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, or subject matter jurisdiction. So they, in essence, overruled BJN, and they also overruled the part of BJN that said you only get 30 days to do the temporary, and that 30 days cannot be extended. Now 938.365 sub 6 specifically says 30 days, but not counting the time periods that are X'd out under 938.315 sub 1. So they absolutely, in essence, overruled all parts of BJN. And in addition, if I may just go on, at the time BJN and the cases prior to it were decided, termination of parental rights, CHIPS, and delinquent kids were all treated under 48. The 1995 Act separated delinquent kids out and put them in 938. And in that statute, unlike the previous statute, 48, the best interest of the child is not paramount. The legislature doesn't even use that term in 938. What it says is we want to protect the public from further crimes. We want to prevent further acts of delinquency. We want to reach these kids and provide them services so that they can become competent, functional adults, basically. And so that policy of saying, well, best interest of the kid, and then defining that as, well, you get out when you get out, whether you need more help or not, is not present in 938. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Wilman. Ms. Alicia?
If I may, I'd like to get practical here at the end. And on a practical level, we know that the only piece of paper in this file that talks about expiration on October 23rd is an order that says this expires on October 23rd. Michael's in secure detention. What if his mother comes in and does say, look, here's a piece of paper. This expired. I want him home. Let's bring him home. There's nothing in the file that says the order is temporarily extended. There's no written order. You can't look back at the minutes and see any acknowledgement that there's a temporary extension. There's no statement on the record. We could go to the court reporters. We can't find anything. The parties wouldn't say, oh, yes, I remember the temporary extension. That's not there. The court doesn't say that. Michael certainly wouldn't say the order had been temporarily extended. And the people holding him in secure detention don't know. So what if it's a foster parent and the mother comes in and says, well, this order expired. And we have nothing that says, oh, yes, we still have jurisdiction over Michael. And that's the problem in this case. And again, on a practical level, there's nothing there. And we go back and we try to put it there, and the judge says, well, I'll retroactively do it, or I did it by inference. But the reality of it is this order was not extended. He never extended this order. And the reason for that is pretty clear. He didn't extend it because he didn't know it was going to expire. Justice Bradley asked, why didn't they bring in a new judge? Well, the quick answer is because they didn't know they had to, because nobody looked at that expiration date. So what I'm concerned about is if we try to go back and fix this, when it clearly wasn't there to begin with, when there was no extension to begin with, how do we straighten that out? I mean, we can see what a mess this became. What do we say to that mother who says, no, he gets to come out? We say, well, actually, we're going to hold him a little bit longer. When we have time, then we'll have a hearing and we'll try to figure it out. And if we didn't actually do it then, we'll talk about how we could have or we would have if we had known about it. I mean, this is some serious liberty interest for this kid. He was in secure detention.
You want to talk practically as a practical matter. There was a hearing on the 20th. That was in the record. You're saying, well, why wouldn't they? They would have said, well, he has a hearing tomorrow at 10:30.
That's correct. What if it wasn't on the 24th? What if it was a month later?
No, I'm just using the facts that you...
And the other response would be, well, sure, he has a hearing, but what good does that do? Then we should be home. His order expired. I would say it's not great comfort to the kid in secure detention to say, well, wait another day and we'll figure it out. I mean, his perception is, I did my year. My order expired.
But then he knew he had a hearing on the 24th, too. He was there with his attorney.
And he said, I want to go home.
Right, and I understand that argument. But on a practical sense, I understand what Judge Wilcox is saying. What he's saying is if we follow your example and you look in the file, the mom's there and says, I want to take my son home. They're going to look in the file and say, well, he has a hearing tomorrow. Why don't you raise that with the judge tomorrow? But it appears the court is continuing to... interact with them. I mean, no one's going to decide jurisdictional questions in the hypothetical.
Sure, I understand it, but we avoid the problem entirely if the judge either makes a record of it or he enters an order. We've got a kid, okay, we can say one day, what's a day? Well, it turned out to be a lot more than that for him, obviously, and in a different fact situation, we could have had it be many more days down the road. How long do we have somebody locked up where we say, well, it's okay because we'll figure it out later? It was a day here, but how long... do we say that that's all right? Or do we say, here's the piece of paper. It very clearly says the order expires on the 23rd. You should know that, court. You should know that, petitioner. Raise that. There's a mechanism in place here to deal with situations where the calendar is crowded.
I should have asked the state this, but too late. It's one thing to say, under these fact situations, as the state said. It's another to try and interpret the statute. So, for future cases, it is clear what the powers of the court are and who has to say what to whom and when. So, that's a preface to the question of how, I know you want to get your client off, but how should this statute be interpreted for all future cases, including your client's case?
I think it can be done very simply, and that is the language in there says that if the court is unable, it may extend. That, to me, means
the after a request by the state.
Right. The state filed a petition for extension. At that point, the statute says, well, if you can't do it, you can have an extra 30 days. If you're unable, you may extend for an additional 30 days. What I think this court should rule is the court is required to actually, in fact, temporarily extend the order. That can happen in a written order, temporarily extending it. It can happen on the record where the court says, I crowded calendar, I have a lot of TPRs, I can't fit this in, I'm temporarily extending it. I don't think this is a large burden. It's just saying, in some way, shape, or form, I am temporarily extending this order.
If that's not done, the case is finished.
Yes.
Because the disposition order is ended.
Yes.
That's your position.
It wouldn't be enough to say I have a crowded calendar, I'm putting this on the 24th, because that was done. I mean, he said I had a crowded calendar.
That's correct.
He has to say, we're back to the magic words. He has to say the magic words, right?
I'm asking the court to extend the order. If you're not aware the order expired, you're not extending the order. Again, I think it comes down to a difference between a scheduling hearing and an extension of the disposition order. This was a scheduling hearing. I'm asking the court to actually extend the order.
Counsel, I have one quick question before you go. Ms. Wellman argues that you are saying that this is not a time limit case, so therefore the various parts of the statute that were pointed out that do permit extensions of time limits don't apply. And if it's not a time limit case, then you've waived your objection to competency under MCRD. Essentially, she's saying you're arguing it both ways. You want it to be a time limit for one thing, but you don't for something else. Would you respond to that?
Yeah, I don't want it to be a time limit at all. No time limit under any circumstances. I do not want that. My argument is it's completely outside of MCRD, one, because this was a loss of personal jurisdiction, which is not addressed by MCRD. So that's my position. If this court goes into MCRD, my position is MCRD doesn't apply. There are a couple reasons for that. One, it's a different kind of competency than MCRD involved this statutory mandate discussion. I'm saying the order expired. There's anything to be applied. The order expired. That's how competency was lost. The analysis I used in the brief was to say there seems to be two kind of MCRDs. There's the time limit exception. There's the exception to MCRD, and there's everything else. And I'm saying we're an exception. We're an exception. Time limits are an exception. We're both exceptions, but we're not a time limit. So
you think you are an exception to MCRD. You're not a time limit. Are you an exception?
Yeah, I think that MCRD doesn't apply, which I suppose is different from me saying that we're an exception.
Okay.
My position is it doesn't apply.
I understand your argument on personal jurisdiction. Tell me why it doesn't apply for the competency issue.
Because when you look at the facts of MCRD, certainly they don't line up with this case factually. I don't think anyone would say that they're similar in any way.
I agree.
So the question becomes, well, what is this then? And when I look at the language of that and I see MCRD saying, well, when the court fails to apply a statutory mandate, it loses competency. And then the court does the waiver analysis. And what I'm saying is, well, again, I had trouble figuring out how my case fit into that. And maybe the conclusion then, and the conclusion I reached is, this isn't really a question of the court failing to apply a statutory mandate. The order just expired. So there are other kinds of competency then besides the MCRD competency, which was failure to apply the statutory mandate. There's mine. It doesn't quite fit. I mean, the MCRD analysis I find awkward, which is probably for another day. But my bottom line is we don't fit under it. Even if you look to competency, we don't fit under it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Alicia. Thank you, Ms. Wellman, for your arguments today. And not or maybe MCRD case, and not or maybe waiver objection. And that concludes our hearing today and the March calendar for 03-2934 State versus Michael S. And thank you both for excellent arguments. The court is adjourned, and it will meet in the conference room at 3:20.